Pull up a chair. I want you to smell something first. Burnt castor oil. That's what a rotary engine throws back in your face. A fine warm mist of it, and if you flew behind one long enough you learned to live with a sour stomach, because that oil got into everything. Your goggles, your teeth, the collar of your shirt. Whole generation of pilots walked around in the 1920s smelling faintly of a hospital and a garage at the same time. That smell is where this story lives. This is Radio Hangar, I'm Taildragger, and this is The Hangar, where we tell the stories that don't make it into the textbooks. And today I want to talk about the greatest traveling air show this country ever saw, an outfit that put more Americans in an airplane for the very first time than anybody before or since, the Gates Flying Circus. Now, before I get rolling, let me tell you who keeps the coffee hot around here. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up the ladder. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it, and every one of those coins tells a story, which is the whole point around this hangar, isn't it? Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let's set the scene. The Great War ends in 1918, and the United States government, which had cranked up factories to build training airplanes, suddenly finds itself sitting on a mountain of them. The Curtiss Jenny, the JN-4, a big, patient, forgiving biplane that had taught thousands of young men to fly, and now nobody needed them, so the government sold them off. Cheap. I mean cheap. You could buy a brand new Jenny, still in the crate, packing grease, still on the fittings, for a few $100s. Some fellas got them for less. A war surplus airplane for the price of a good used car. And here's where it gets interesting. Because all across America there were young men who had learned to fly in that war, or had wanted to and missed it. And now they had a way to buy an airplane for pocket change. But there were no airlines yet. No airports to speak of. No cargo runs. There was no job called pilot, so what do you do with an airplane and no work? You go find the work. You fly out to some farm town that has never seen an airplane up close. You set her down in a pasture and you wait. Folks come running. They always came running. And you lean on the wing and you say real casual, rides $5, take you up over your own house, show you your barn from 1,000 feet. That was barnstorming. And for a few wild years it was the only flying game in town. Now most barnstormers worked alone, or in twos. A pilot and maybe a mechanic, drifting from county fair to county fair, sleeping under the wing, patching the fabric with whatever they could find. Romantic as all get out, but it was a hand-to-mouth life. Ivan Gates had a bigger idea. Gates wasn't really a pilot himself. He was a promoter, a showman, a man who understood that the airplane in 1920 was not transportation. It was spectacle. It was the most thrilling thing a person in a small town could possibly lay eyes on. And Gates figured if one airplane drew a crowd, then a whole fleet of them, with a name and a reputation and an advance man riding into town ahead of the show. Why? That could draw thousands. So he built the Gates Flying Circus. Not one airplane, a squadron. Painted up, numbered, with pilots and wing walkers and parachute jumpers all working as a troop. They'd roll into a town, tack up posters, buzz the main street to wake everybody up, and put on a show that folks would talk about for the rest of their lives, and the man who became the heart of that show was a pilot named Clyde Pangborn. Now, pull in close for this one, because Pangborn is one of those characters that if you put him in a movie, folks would say you made him up. Quiet fella. Serious. Didn't drink much, didn't brag, but in the air he was absolutely fearless in a way that's hard to explain to modern ears. They called him Upside Down Pangborn, and he earned the name honestly, because he would fly that standard biplane inverted low enough over the crowd that they could read the numbers on the wings. Pangborn became the field manager and chief pilot of the Gates outfit, and under him that circus did something nobody had ever done. They ran it like a business and a war campaign at the same time. Advance men going town to town, a schedule, a payroll. At its peak, the Gates Flying Circus had a stable of airplanes and a roster of the best low-level pilots and stunt people in the country. And here's the number that ought to stop you cold. Over the years they ran, the Gates Flying Circus is said to have carried better than 1 million passengers. 1 million, think about what that means. In the 1920s, if you were an ordinary American, a farmer, a shopkeeper, a schoolteacher, a kid, and you got your very first airplane ride, there is a real good chance it was in a Gates airplane, flown by one of Pangborn's pilots, out of a cow pasture on a Sunday afternoon. They didn't just put on a show, they introduced a whole nation to the sky. Now let me tell you how the show actually went, because the flying was something else. The circus would come over the town in formation, engines snarling, that castor oil smell drifting down. They'd break off and start the stunts, loops, rolls, spins that looked like the airplane was falling clean out of the sky before it snapped back to life at the last second. And Pangborn upside down, right over the grandstand, close enough that ladies would gasp and grab their hats.
Then came the wing walkers.
Now I want you to picture this honestly. No parachute. Most of the time, no parachute at all, because a chute was heavy and it spoiled the effect. A man in a leather helmet and jodhpurs climbs out of the front cockpit at 70-80 miles an hour into a wind that is trying to peel him off the airplane like a wet leaf. He works his way out along the lower wing, hanging on to flying wires thinner than your finger, and he stands up, out at the wingtip, arms spread, and the whole town below him just loses their minds. There was a stunt they called the plane change. Two airplanes, flying formation, one stacked above the other. A man climbs to the top wing of the lower ship, reaches up for a rope ladder trailing from the airplane above him, and transfers from one moving airplane to another in midair. Nothing but 800 feet of Nebraska summer between him and the ground. Some of them did it hanging by their teeth. There was a special mouthpiece, a leather bit rigged to the airplane, and a performer would clamp down on it and let go with both hands and hang there, spinning over the crowd. Now here's where it gets interesting and a little dark. A lot of these folks got hurt, some of them got killed. The wind, a slipped grip, a gust off a tree line at the wrong second. Wing walking was the deadliest job in a deadly business, and everybody out there knew it. They did it anyway, because for a young person in 1922, that was as alive as a human being could possibly feel. Let me tell you my favorite thing the Gates Circus did, though. It wasn't a stunt at all. It was a piece of pure showmanship that tells you everything about Ivan Gates and the mind of a promoter. They cut the price for a long stretch. The standard barnstorming ride was $5, real money back then. A day's wage for a lot of folks. And plenty of people wanted to go up, but just couldn't spare it. So Gates at certain shows dropped the price of a ride to $1, a single dollar.
And the crowds came in like a tide. They'd fly people all day long, one after another, load them in, take them around the pattern, set them down grinning, load in the next one. Turned the whole operation into an assembly line of joy. Gates understood something the airlines wouldn't figure out for another 50 years. You make it up on volume, you get the whole town in the air, and the whole town goes home believing in airplanes. That right there is how you build an aviation nation. Not with a government program, with a $1 ride and a pilot willing to spend his Sunday flying strangers over their own rooftops. Now, every golden age ends, and I'd be a liar if I told you this one didn't. Two things killed the barnstorming era and the Gates Flying Circus with it. The first was simple arithmetic. Those war surplus jennies didn't last forever. Wood rots, fabric tears, engines wear out, and the supply of cheap airplanes dried up. You couldn't just buy another one for a few hundred dollars anymore. The second thing was the government, and I'll be honest with you, I've got mixed feelings about it to this day. In 1926, Congress passed the Air Commerce Act, and for the first time, the federal government started licensing pilots and licensing airplanes and writing rules about how low you could fly and where, and a whole lot of what made barnstorming barnstorming was suddenly illegal. You couldn't just drop into any old pasture. You couldn't fly a stunt at 50 feet over a crowd of people. You couldn't put a man out on the wing without a parachute anymore. The wild, free, dangerous heart of the thing got regulated right out of existence.
Now, back when Avgas was cheap and airspace was free, an old barnstormer would grumble about all that, and part of me grumbles along with him. Something was lost, something wild and brave and beautifully reckless. But here's the other half of the truth. And I've flown long enough to say it plainly. Those rules are the reason we have an aviation system at all. The licensing that came out of that act became the Bureau of Air Commerce, and eventually the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA. The certificate in your wallet, the medical, the annual on your airplane, the whole framework that lets you and me strap in on a Saturday morning, with a reasonable expectation of coming home. That all traces back to the moment the country decided the barnstorming days had to end. The barnstormers flew so wild that they forced a nation to grow up around them. And look what happened to the people in this story. Clyde Pangborn, Upside Down Pangborn, the pasture stunt pilot. In 1931, just a few years after the circus wound down, he and a fella named Hugh Herndon made the first nonstop flight across the Pacific Ocean, Japan to the state of Washington. He dropped his landing gear into the sea after takeoff to cut the drag and save fuel, then set that airplane down on its belly on the far shore of an ocean nobody had ever crossed nonstop. The Wingwalker's chief pilot became one of the great long-distance aviators of the age. That's the thing about the barnstorming era that I want you to carry out of this hangar today. It looks from a distance, like a sideshow, daredevils and cowpastures and folks hanging off wings for a crowd. But it was the nursery. It's where the pilots came from. It's where the mechanics learned their trade.
It's where 1 million ordinary Americans touched the sky for the first time and decided the airplane was theirs too. Everything that came after, the airmail, the airlines, the whole modern world of flight, it grew out of that castor oil-soaked pasture on a Sunday afternoon. My thanks on this one to the good work of the National Air and Space Museum, whose historians have kept Pangborn's story straight, and to the aviation writers over the years at EAA who've kept the barnstorming era from fading out of memory. If you want to see a real Jenny and hear one run, get yourself to a good Warbird Museum. It's a sound you won't forget. You can find us anytime at RadioHangar.com. And the next time you're sitting in your airplane, waiting on the run-up, smelling that hot oil come off the cowl, remember there was a fella named Pangborn who flew that same air upside down over a crowd of farmers who'd never seen the ground from above. We're all riding in his slipstream. Keep the greasy side down. I'll see you next time.